By the time America had built its strength back up, it would be too late to change things. It was all about space and time, really. Both worked against a country crippled by internal difficulties, and therefore robbed of her purpose. How clever of the Japanese to see that. "It went better than I expected," Durling said. He'd walked over to Ryan's office for the chat, a first for both of them. "You really think so?" Jack said in surprise. "Remember, I inherited most of the cabinet from Bob," the president sat down. "Their focus is domestic. That's been my problem all along." "You need a new SecDef and a new chairman," the National Security Advisor observed coldly. "I know that, but the timing is bad for it," Durling smiled. "It gives you a slightly wider purview, Jack, but I have a question to ask you first." "I don't know if we can bring it off." Ryan was doodling on his pad. "We have to take the missiles out of play first." "Yes, sir. I know that. We'll find them. At least I expect that we will, one way or another. The other wild cards are hostages and our ability to hit the islands. This war, if that's what it is, has different rules. I'm not sure what those rules are yet." Ryan was still working on the public part of the problem. How would the American people react? How would the Japanese? "You want some input from your commander-in-chief?" Durling asked. That was good enough to generate another smile. "You bet." "I fought in a war where the other side made the rules," Durling observed. "It didn't work out very well." "Which leads me to a question," Jack said.
"Ask it."
"How far can we go?"
The president considered.
"That's too open-ended."
"The enemy command authority is usually a legitimate target of war, but heretofore those people have been in uniform."
"You mean going after the Zaibatsu?"
"Yes, sir. Our best information is that they're the ones giving the orders. But they're civilians, and going directly after them could seem like assassination."
"We'll cross that bridge when we get to it, Jack."
The president stood to leave, having said what he'd come in to say. Fair enough. A slightly wider purview, Ryan thought. That could mean many things. Mainly it meant that he had the opportunity to run with the ball, but all alone, unprotected. Well, Jack thought, you've done that before.
"What have we done?" Koga asked. "What have we allowed them to do?"
"It's so easy for them," responded a political aide of long standing. He didn't have to say who them was. "We cannot ourselves assert our power, and divided it's just so easy for them to push us in any direction they want. And over time," the man shrugged.
"And over time the policy of our country has been decided by 20 or 30 men elected by no one but their own corporate boardrooms."
"But this far?" Koga asked.
"But this far?"
"We are where we are. Would you prefer that we deny it?" the man asked.
"And who protects the people now?"
The former, that word, was bitter indeed, Prime Minister asked, leading with his chin and knowing it.
"Koto, of course." "We cannot permit that. You know what he follows."
Koga's counselor nodded and would have smiled but for the gravity of the moment.
"Tell me," Mogataru Koga asked, "what is honor? What does it dictate now?"
"Our duty, Prime Minister, is to the people," replied a man whose friendship with the politician went back to Tokyo University. Then he remembered a quote from a Westerner, Cicero, he thought. "The good of the people is the highest law."
And that said it all, Koga thought. He wondered if treason always began that way. It was something he'd sleep on, except that he knew that he wouldn't sleep at all that night.
"This morning," Koga thought with a grunt, checking his watch.
"We're sure that it has to be standard gauge track?" "You can resection the photos we have yourself," Betsy Fleming told him. They were back in the Pentagon headquarters of the National Reconnaissance Office. "The transporter car our people saw is standard gauge."
Disinformation, maybe? The NRO analyst asked. The diameter of the SS-19 is 2.82 meters, Chris Scott replied, handing over a fax from Russia. Throw in another 270 centimeters for the transport container. I ran the numbers myself. The narrow gauge track over there would be marginal for an object of that width. Possible, but marginal. You have to figure, Betsy went on, that they're not going to take too many chances. Besides, the Russians also considered a rail transport mode for the Mod 4 version and designed the bird for that, and the Russian rail gauge... Yeah, I forgot that. It's larger than our standard, isn't it? The analyst nodded. Okay, that makes the job easier. He turned back to his computer and executed a tasking order that he drafted a few hours earlier. For every pass over Japan, the narrow-focus high-resolution cameras would track down along precise coordinates. Interestingly, Amtrak had the best current information on Japanese railroads, and even now one of their executives was being briefed in on the security rules pertaining to overhead imagery. It was a pretty simple briefing, really. Tell anyone what you see, and figure out a lengthy vacation at Marion, Illinois. The computer-generated order went to Sunnyvale, California, from there to a military communications satellite, and thence to the two orbiting KH-11 satellites, one of which would overfly Japan in 50 minutes, the other 10 minutes after that. All three people wondered how good the Japanese were at camouflaging. The hell of it was, they might never find out. All they could do, really, was wait. They would look at the imagery in real time as it came in, but unless there were overt signs pointing to what they sought, the real work would be done over hours and days, if they were lucky. Kuroshio was on the surface, never something to make a submarine commander happy. They wouldn't be here long. Fuel was coming aboard through two large-diameter hoses, and other stores, mainly food, were lowered by crane to crewmen waiting on the deck. His Navy didn't have a proper submarine tender, Commander Ugaki knew. Mainly they used tank landing ships for the purpose, but those were fulfilling other purposes now, and he was stuck with a merchantman whose crew was enthusiastic, but unfamiliar with the tasks they were now attempting. His was the last boat into Agana Harbor because he'd been the one farthest away from the Marianas when the occupation had begun. He'd fired only one torpedo and was gratified to see how well the Type 89 had worked. That was good. The merchantman didn't have the equipment to reload him properly, but the captain told himself he had 15 more and 4 Harpoon missiles, and if the Americans offered him that many targets, so much the better. Those crewmen not on duty loading stores on the afterdeck were crowded forward getting some sun, as submariners often did, as indeed their captain was doing, bare-chested atop the sail, drinking tea, and smiling for everyone to see. His next mission was to patrol the area west of the Bonins to intercept any American ship, more likely a submarine, that attempted to close the home islands. It promised to be typical submarine duty, Ugaki thought, dull but demanding. He'd have to talk to his crew about how important it was. So, where's the patrol line? Jones asked, pushing the envelope again. Along 165 east for the moment, Admiral Mancuso said, pointing at the chart. We're thin, Jonesy. Before I commit them to battle, I want them to get used to the idea. I want the COs to drill their people up. You're never ready enough, Ron. Never. True, the civilian conceded. He'd come over with SOSUS printouts to demonstrate that all known submarine contacts were off the screen. Two hydrophone arrays that were operated from the island of Guam were no longer available. Though connected by undersea cable to the rest of the network, they'd evidently been turned off by the monitoring facility on Guam, and nobody at Pearl had yet been able to trick them back on. The good news was that a backup array off Samar in the Philippines was still operating, but it could not detect the Japanese SSKs shown by satellite to be replenishing off Agana. They'd even gotten a good count. Probably, Mancuso thought. The Japanese still painted the hull numbers on the sails, and the satellite cameras could read them. Unless the Japanese, like the Russians and then the Americans, had learned to spoof reconnaissance efforts by playing with the numbers, or simply erase them entirely. It would be nice to have a few more fast attacks, wouldn't it? Jones observed after a minute's contemplation of the chart.
Sure would. Maybe if we can get some direction from Washington.
His voice trailed off, and Mancuso thought a little more. The location of every sub under his command was marked with a black silhouette, even the ones in overhaul status. Those were marked in white, showing availability dates, which was not much help at the moment. But there were five such silhouettes at Bremerton, weren't there? The special report card appeared on all the major TV networks. In every case, the hushed voice of an anchor person told people that their network shows would be interrupted by a speech from the president about the economic crisis with which his administration had been dealing since the weekend. Then came the presidential seal. Those who had been following the events were surprised to see the president smiling.
Good evening. My fellow Americans, last week we saw a major event take place in the American financial system. I want to begin my report to you by saying that the American economy is strong. Now, he smiled, that may seem a strange pronouncement given all that you've heard in the media and elsewhere, but let me tell you why that is so. I'll start off with a question. What has changed? American workers are still making cars in Detroit and elsewhere. American workers are still making steel. Kansas farmers have their winter wheat in and are preparing for a new planting season. They're still making computers in the Silicon Valley. They're still making tires in Akron. Boeing is still making airplanes. They're still pumping oil out of the ground in Texas and Alaska. They're still mining coal in West Virginia. All the things you were doing a week ago, you are still doing. So, what has changed? What changed was this. Some electrons traveled along some copper wires, telephone lines like this one. The president held up a phone cord and tossed it aside on his desk. And that's all. He went on in the voice of a good, smart neighbor come to the house to offer some kindly advice. Not one person has lost his life. Not a single business has lost a building. The wealth of our nation is unchanged. Nothing has gone away. And yet, my fellow Americans, we've begun to panic. Over what? In the past 4 days, we've determined that a deliberate attempt was made to tamper with the U.S. financial markets. The United States Department of Justice, with the assistance of some good Americans within those markets, is now building a criminal case against the people responsible for that. I cannot go further at the moment because even your president does not have the right to tamper with the right of any person to a fair and impartial trial. But we do know what happened, and we do know that what happened is entirely artificial. Now, what are we going to do about it? Roger Durling asked. The financial markets have been closed all week. They will reopen at noon on Friday, and...
Chapter 33 Reversal Points.
It can't possibly work, Kozo Matsuda said over the translation. Raizo's plan was perfect, better than perfect, he went on, talking as much to himself as the telephone receiver. Before the crash, he'd worked in conjunction with a banker associate to use the opportunity to cash in on the T-bill transactions, which had gone a long way to recapitalizing his troubled conglomerate. It had also made his cash account yen-heavy in the face of international obligations. But that was not a problem, was it? Not with the renewed strength of the yen and corresponding weakness of the American dollar. It might even make sense, he thought, to purchase American interests through intermediaries. A good strategic move once the American equities market resumed its freefall. When do the European markets open? Somehow, in the excitement of the moment, he couldn't remember. London is 9 hours behind us. Germany and Holland are 8, 4 this afternoon, the man on the other end of the phone said. Our people have their instructions. And those were clear. To use the renewed power of their national currency to buy as many European equities as possible, so that when the financial panic ended 2 or 3 years from now, Japan would be so enmeshed in that multinational economy as to be a totally integral part of it.
so vital to their survival that separation would run the renewed danger of financial collapse. And they wouldn't risk that, not after recovery from the worst economic crisis in three generations, and certainly not after Japan had played so important and selfless a part in restoring prosperity to 300 million Europeans. It was troubling that the Americans suspected a hand in what had taken place, but Yamada-san had assured them all that no record could possibly exist. Wasn't that the masterstroke of the entire event? The elimination of records and their replacement with chaos. Businesses could not operate without precise financial records of their transactions, and denied those, they simply stopped. Rebuilding them would require weeks or months, Matsuda was sure, during which time the paralysis would allow Japan, more precisely his fellow Zaibatsu, to cash in addition to the brilliant strategic moves Yamada had executed through their government agencies. The integrated nature of the plan was the reason why all his fellows had signed on to it.
"It really doesn't matter, Kozo. We took Europe down, too, and the only liquidity left in the world is ours."
"Good one, boss," Ryan said, leaning on the doorframe.
"A long way to go," Derling said, leaving his chair and heading out of the Oval Office before saying anything more.
The President and National Security Advisor headed into the White House proper, past the technicians who alone had been allowed in. It wasn't time to face reporters yet.
"It's amazing how philosophical it is," Jack said as they took the elevator to the residential floor.
"Metaphysics, eh? You did go to a Jesuit school, didn't you?"
"Three, actually." "What is reality?" Jack asked rhetorically. "Reality to them is electrons and computer screens, and if there's one thing I learned on the street, it's that they don't know investments worth a damn. Except Yamada, I suppose."
"Well, he did all right, didn't he?" Derling asked.
"He should have left the records alone. If he'd left us in free fall," Ryan shrugged, "it might just have kept going."
"It just never occurred to him that we might not play by his rules. And that," Jack told himself, "would be the key to everything." The President's speech had been a fine mix of things said and unsaid, and the targeting of the speech had been precise. It had been, in fact, the first psyop of a war.
"The press can't stay dumb forever."
"I know." Ryan even knew where the leak would start, and the only reason it hadn't already was the FBI. "But we need to keep them dumb just a little longer." It started cautiously, not really as part of any operational plan at all, but more as a precursor to one. Four B-1B Lancer bombers lifted off from Elmendorf Air Force Base in Alaska, followed by two KC-10 tankers. The combination of latitude and time of year guaranteed darkness. Their bomb bays were fitted with fuel tanks instead of weapons. Each aircraft had a crew of four, pilot and co-pilot, plus two systems operators. The Lancer was a sleek aircraft, a bomber equipped with a fighter's stick instead of a more conventional control yoke, and pilots who had flown both said that the B-1B felt and flew like a slightly heavy F-4 Phantom, its greater weight and larger size giving the bomber greater stability, and for now, a smoother ride. For the moment, the staggered formation of six flew International Route R-220, maintaining the lateral spacing expected of commercial air traffic. 1,000 miles and 2 hours out, passing Shemya and leaving ground control radar coverage, the six aircraft turned north briefly. The tankers held steady while the bombers, one by one, eased underneath to take on fuel, a procedure that lasted about 12 minutes in each case. Finished, the bombers continued southwest while the tankers turned to land at Shemya, where they would refill their own tanks. The four bombers descended to 25,000 feet, which took them below the regular stream of commercial air traffic and allowed more freedom of maneuver. They continued close to R-220, the westernmost of the commercial flight tracks, skimming down past the Kamchatka Peninsula. Systems were flipped on in the back. Though designed as a penetrating bomber, the B-1B fulfilled many roles, one of which was electronic intelligence. The body of any military aircraft is studded with small structures that look for all the world like the fins on fish.
These objects are invariably antennas of one sort or another, and the graceful fairing has no more sinister purpose than to reduce drag. The Lancer had many of them designed to gather in radar and other electronic signals and pass them along to internal equipment which analyzed the data. Some of the work was done in real time by the flight crew. The idea was for the bomber to monitor hostile radar, the better to allow its crew to avoid detection and deliver its bombs. At the Nogal reporting point, about 300 miles outside the Japanese air defense identification zone, the bombers split into a patrol line with roughly 50 miles separating the aircraft and descended to 10,000 feet. Crewmen rubbed their hands together, pulled their seatbelts a little tighter, and started concentrating. Cockpit chatter lessened to that required by the mission, and tape recorders were flipped on. Satellite monitoring told them that the Japanese Air Force had airborne early warning aircraft, E-767s, operating almost continuously, and those were the defensive assets that the bomber crews feared most. Flying high, the E-767s could see far. Mobile, they could move to deal with threats with a high degree of efficiency. Worst of all, they invariably operated in conjunction with fighters, and fighters had eyes in them. And behind the eyes were brains, and weapons with brains in them were the most frightening of all. "Okay, there's the first one," one of the system's operators said. It wasn't really the first. For practice of sorts, they'd calibrated their equipment on Russian air defense radars, but for the first time in the collective memory of all 16 airmen, it wasn't Russian radars and fighters which concerned them. Low frequency, fixed, known location. They were receiving what operators often called fuzz. The radar in question was under the horizon and too far away to detect their semi-stealthy aircraft. As you can see a person holding a flashlight long before the light reveals your presence to the holder, so it was with radar. The powerful transmitter was as much a warning beacon to unwanted guests as a lookout for its owners. The location, frequency, pulse repetition rate, and estimated power of the radar was noted and logged. A display on the electronic warfare officer's board showed the coverage for that radar. The display was repeated on the pilot's console with the danger area marked in red. He'd stay well clear of it. "Next," the EWO said. "Wow, talk about power. This one's airborne. Must be one of their new ones. It's definitely moving south to north, now bearing 202. "Copy," the pilot acknowledged quietly, his eyes scanning all around the dark sky. The Lancer was really proceeding on autopilot, but his right hand was only inches from the stick, ready to jerk the bomber to the left, dive to the deck, and go to burner. There were fighters somewhere off to his right, probably two F-15s, but they would stay close to E-767s. "Another one. 195 just appeared. Different freak, and stand by," the electronics officer said. "Okay, major frequency change. He's probably in an over-the-horizon mode now." "Could he have us?" the pilot asked, checking his avoidance screen again. Outside the red keep-out zone was a yellow section that the pilot thought of as the maybe zone. They were at most a few minutes away from entering that zone, and maybe seemed very worrisome indeed at the moment, nearly 3,000 miles from Elmendorf Air Force Base. "Not sure. It's possible." "Recommend we come left," the EWO said judiciously. On that advice, he felt the aircraft bank 5 degrees. The mission wasn't about taking risks. It was about gathering information, as a gambler would observe a table before taking his seat and putting his chips in play. "I think there's somebody out there," one of the E-767 operators said. 015 southerly course. Hard to hold it." The rotodome atop the E-767 was like few others in the world, and all of them were Japanese. Three of them were operating on the eastern approaches to their country. Transmitting up to 3 million watts of electrical energy, it had 4 times the power of anything the Americans had aloft. But the true sophistication of the system lay not in its power, but in its mode of delivery. Essentially a smaller version of the spy radar carried on the Congo-class destroyers, the array was composed of thousands of solid-state diodes that could scan both electronically and mechanically, and jump in frequency to suit the needs of the moment. For long-range detection, a relatively low frequency was best. However, though the waves curved around the visible horizon somewhat, it was at the cost of poor resolution. The operator was getting a hit on only every third sweep or so. The system software had not yet learned to distinguish clutter from the purposeful activities of a human mind, at least not in all cases, and not, unfortunately, at this frequency setting. "Are you sure?" the senior controller asked over the intercom line. He just called up the display himself and didn't see anything yet. "Here." The first man moved his cursor and marked the contact when it reappeared. He wished they could improve that software. "Wait. Look here." He selected another blip and marked it, too. It disappeared almost at once, but came back in 15 seconds. "See. Southerly course, speed, 500 knots. "Excellent," the senior controller activated his radio microphone and reported to his ground station that Japanese air defenses were being probed for the first time. The only surprise, really, was that it had taken them so long. "This is where things get interesting," he thought, wondering what would happen next now that the games had begun. "No more of those E's?" the pilot asked. "No, just the two." "I thought I had a little fuzz a minute ago," the Iwo said, "but it faded out." He didn't need to explain that with the sensitivity of his instruments he was probably getting readings on garage door openers as well. A moment later another ground radar was plotted. The patrol line angled back west one by one as they passed the coverage of the two E-767s, still on a southwesterly base course, now halfway down the largest home island, Honshu, which was well over 300 miles to their right. The co-pilots of each of the four aircraft looked exclusively west now, while the aircraft commanders scanned for possible air traffic to their front. It was tense, but routine, not unlike driving through a neighborhood in which one didn't want to live. So long as the lights were all green, you didn't get too worried, but you didn't like the looks your car got. The crew of the third E-767 was unhappy, and their fighter escorts even more so. Enemy aircraft were looking at their coastline, and even if they were 600 kilometers out, they still didn't belong in the neighborhood. But they switched their radar systems to standby. Probably EC-135s, they thought, surveillance aircraft assembling an electronic order of battle for their country. And if the American mission were to gather information, then the smart thing to do was to deny them the information they wanted. And it was easy to do, or so the radar controller officers told themselves. "We'll go closer in the next time," the aircraft commander told himself. First, electronics experts would have to examine the data and try to determine what was and what wasn't safe, betting the lives of fellow Air Force officers with their conclusions. That was a happy thought. The crew relaxed, yawned, and started talking, mainly about the mission and what they had learned. 4.5 hours back to Elmendorf and a shower and some mandated crew rest. The Japanese controllers were still not completely sure that they'd had contacts at all, but that would be determined by examining their onboard tapes. Their patrol patterns returned to their normal monitoring of commercial air traffic, and a few comments were exchanged on why the devil that traffic still continued. The answers were mainly shrugs and raised eyebrows, and even more uncertainty than had existed when they'd thought they were tracking contacts. There was just something about looking at a radar screen for more than a few hours. Sooner or later your imagination took over, and the more you thought about it, the worse it got. But that, they knew, was the same for the other side in the game, too. The central bank heads were accustomed to VIP treatment. Their flights all arrived at John F. Kennedy International within the same hour. Each was met by a senior diplomat from their respective countries' UN delegations, whisked past customs control and sent to the city in a car with diplomatic tags. The common destination surprised them all, but the Federal Reserve Chairman explained that for convenience the New York FBI office was a better place for coordination than the local Federal Reserve Bank, especially since it was large enough to accommodate the directors of the major trading houses, and since antitrust regulations were being suspended in the interest of American national security. The notification bemused the European visitors. Finally, they thought, America understood the national security implications of financial matters. It had certainly taken them long enough. George Winston and Mark Gant began their final briefing on the events of the previous week after an introduction from the chairman and Secretary Fiedler, and by this time they had the presentation down pat. "Bloody clever," the head of the Bank of England observed to his German counterpart.
"Jawohl," was the whispered reply.
"How do we prevent something like this from happening again?" one of them wondered aloud. "Better record-keeping systems, for starters," Fiedler replied alertly after something approaching a decent night's sleep. "Aside from that, it's something we need to study for a while. Of greater interest are the remedial measures which we must now consider."
"The yen must suffer for this," the French banker observed at once. "And we must help you to protect the dollar in order to protect our own currencies."
"Yes," the Fed chairman nodded at once. "Jean-Jacques, I'm glad you see it the same way we do."
"And to save your equities markets, what will you do?" the head of the Bundesbank asked.
"This is going to sound somewhat crazy, but we think it will work," Secretary Fiedler began, outlining the procedures that President Durling had not revealed in his speech, and whose execution depended to a large degree on European cooperation. The visitors shared a common look, first of incredulity, then of approval. Fiedler smiled. "Might I suggest that we coordinate our activities for Friday?"
9 in the morning was considered an ungodly hour for the commencement of diplomatic negotiations, which helped the situation. The American delegation arrived at the Japanese embassy on Massachusetts Avenue Northwest in private cars, the better to conceal the situation. The formalities were observed in all particulars. The conference room was large, with a correspondingly large table. The Americans took their places on one side and the Japanese on the other. Handshakes were exchanged, because these were diplomats, and such things were to be expected. Tea and coffee were available, but most just poured glasses of ice water into crystal glasses. To the annoyance of the Americans, some of the Japanese smoked. Scott Adler wondered if they did it just to unsettle him, and so to break the ice, he requested and got a smoke from the ambassador's chief aide.
"Thank you for receiving us," he began in a measured voice.
"Welcome again to our embassy," the Japanese ambassador replied, with a friendly, if wary, nod.
"Shall we begin?" Adler asked.
"Please."
The ambassador leaned back in his chair and adopted a relaxed posture to show that he was at ease and that he would listen politely to the impending discourse. "The United States is gravely concerned with developments in the Western Pacific," Adler began. Gravely concerned was the right turn of phrase. When nations are gravely concerned, it usually means that they are contemplating violent action. "As you know, the inhabitants of the Mariana Islands hold American citizenship, and do so because of their own wishes, freely expressed in an election almost 20 years ago. For that reason, the United States of America will not under any circumstances accept Japanese occupation of those islands. And we no, Adler corrected himself. "We demand the return of those islands to U.S. sovereignty forthwith, and the immediate and total removal of Japanese armed forces from the territories in question. We similarly require the immediate release of any and all U.S. citizens held by your government. Failure to comply with these requirements will entail the most serious possible consequences." Everyone in the room thought the opening position statement was unequivocal. If anything, it was a little too strong, the Japanese diplomats thought, even those who deemed their country's actions to be madness.
"I personally regret the tone of your statement," the ambassador replied, giving Adler a diplomatic slap across the face. "On the substantive issues, we will listen to your position and consider its merit against our own security interests."
This was a diplomat's way of saying that Adler would now have to repeat what he had just said with amplifications. It was an implicit demand for another statement, one that conceded something in return for which was the implied promise that there might be a concession on the part of his government. "Perhaps I did not make myself sufficiently clear," Adler said after a sip of water. "Your country has committed an act of war against the United States of America. The consequences of such acts are very grave. We offer your country the opportunity to withdraw from those acts without further bloodshed." The other Americans sitting at the table communicated without words and without a look. Hardball. There had scarcely been time for the American team to develop its thoughts and approaches, and Adler had gone further than they'd expected. "Again," the ambassador said after his own moment of contemplation, "I find your tone personally regrettable. As you know, my country has legitimate security interests and has been the victim of unfortunate legal actions which can have no effect other than severe damage to our economic and physical security. Article 51 of the United Nations Charter specifically recognizes the right of any sovereign nation to self-defense measures. We have done no more than that." It was a skillful parry, even the Americans thought, and the renewed request for civility suggested a real opening for maneuver. The initial discussions went on for another 90 minutes, with neither side budging, each merely repeating words with hardly a change of phrase. Then it was time for a break. Security personnel opened the French doors to the embassy's elegant garden, and everyone went out, ostensibly for fresh air, but really for more work. The garden was too large to bug, especially with a brisk wind blowing through the trees. "So, Chris, we've begun," Seiji Nagumo said, sipping his coffee. He'd chosen it to show how sympathetic he was with the American position, for the same reason Christopher Cook was drinking tea. "What did you expect us to say?" the Deputy Assistant Secretary of State asked. "The opening position is not surprising," Nagumo conceded. Cook looked away, staring at the wall that enclosed the garden. He spoke quietly. "What will you give up?" "Guam, definitely, but it must be demilitarized," Nagumo replied in the same voice. "And you?" "So far, nothing." "You must give me something to work with, Chris," Nagumo observed. "There's nothing to offer except maybe a cessation of hostilities before they actually start." "When will that happen?" "Not any time soon, thank God. We do have time to work with." "Let's make good use of it," Cook urged. "I'll pass that along. Thank you." Nagumo wandered off to join a member of his delegation. Cook did the same, ending up 3 minutes later with Scott Adler. "Guam demilitarized, that's definite. Maybe more. That's not definite." "Interesting," Adler thought. "So, you were right on their allowing us to save face. Nice call, Chris." "What will we offer them back?" "Cornish," the Deputy Secretary of State said coldly. He was thinking about his father and the tattoo on his forearm, and how he learned that a 9 was an upside-down 6, and how his father's freedom had been taken away by a country once allied with the owner of this embassy and its lovely, if cold, garden. It was somewhat unprofessional, and Adler knew it. Japan had offered a safe haven during those years to a few lucky European Jews, one of whom had become a cabinet secretary under Jimmy Carter. Perhaps if his father had been one of those fortunate few, his attitude might be different. But his father hadn't, and his wasn't. "For starters, we lean on them hard and see what happens." "I think that's a mistake," Cook said after a moment. "Maybe," Adler conceded. "But they made the mistake first." The military people didn't like it at all. It annoyed the civilians who had established the site approximately 5 times as fast as these uniformed boneheads would have managed, not to mention doing it in total secrecy and less expensively.
It's never occurred to you to hide the site, the Japanese general demanded.
How could anyone find this? The senior engineer shot back.
They have cameras in orbit that can pick up a packet of cigarettes lying on the ground.
And a whole country to survey, the engineer shrugged.
And we are in the bottom of a valley whose sides are so steep that an inbound ballistic warhead can't possibly hit it without striking those peaks first, the man pointed.
And now they do not even have the missiles they need to do it, he added.
The general had instructions to be patient, and he was, after his initial outburst. It was his site to command now.
The first principle is to deny information to the other side.
So, we hide it then? The engineer asked politely.
Yes.
Camouflage netting on the catenary towers.
They'd done it during the construction phase.
If you have them, it's a good beginning. Later we can consider other more permanent measures.
By train, eh? The Amtrak official noted after the completion of his briefing.
Back when I started in this business, I was with the Great Northern, and the Air Force came to us half a dozen times about how to move missiles around by rail. We ended up moving a lot of concrete in for them.
So you've actually thought this one over a few times, Betsy Fleming asked.
Oh, yeah, the official paused.
Can I see the pictures now?
The goddamn security briefing had taken hours of unnecessary threats, after which he'd been sent back to his hotel to contemplate the forms and to allow the FBI to run a brief security check, he imagined.
Chris Scott flipped the slide projector on. He and Fleming had already made their own analysis, but the purpose of having an outside consultant was to get a free and fresh opinion. The first shot was of the missile, just to give him a feel for the size of the thing. Then they went to the shot of the train car.
Okay. It sure looks like a flat car. Longer than most, probably. Specially made for the load. Steel construction. The Japanese are good at this sort of thing. Good engineers. There's a crane to lift something. How much does one of these monsters weigh?
Figure 100 tons for the missile itself, Betsy answered. Maybe 20 for the transporter container.
That's pretty heavy for a single object, but not all that big a deal.
Well within limits for the car and the roadbed.
He paused for a moment.
I don't see any obvious electronics connections, just the usual brake lines and stuff. You expect them to launch off the cars?
Probably not. You tell us, Chris Scott said.
Same thing I told the Air Force 20-some years ago for the MX. Yeah, you can move them around, but it doesn't make finding them all that hard, unless you assume that you're going to make a whole lot of rail cars that look exactly alike. And even then, like for the main line on the Northern, you have a fairly simple target, just a long, thin line. And guess what? Our main line from Minneapolis to Seattle was longer than all the standard gauge track in their country.
So? Fleming asked.
So this isn't a launch car, it's just a transport car. You didn't need me to tell you that.
No, but it's nice to hear it from somebody else, Betsy thought.
Anything else?
The Air Force kept telling me how delicate the damn things are. They don't like being bumped. At normal operating speeds, you're talking 3 lateral Gs and about 1.5 G of vertical acceleration. That's not good for the missile. Next problem is dimensional. The car's about 90 feet long, and the standard flat car for their railroad is 60 or less. Their railroads are mainly narrow gauge. Know why?
I just assume that they picked... It's all engineering, okay? The Amtrak executive said.
Narrow gauge track gives you the ability to shoehorn into tighter spots, to take sharper turns, generally to do things smaller. But they went to standard gauge for the Shinkansen because for greater speed and stability, you just need it wider. The length of the cargo and the corresponding length of the car to carry it means that if you turn too tightly, the car overlaps the next track, and you run the risk of collision unless you shut down traffic coming the other way every time you move these things. That's why the missile's somewhere off the Shinkansen line. It has to be. Then next, there's the problem of the cargo. It really messes things up for everybody.
Keep going, Betsy Fleming said. Because the missiles are so delicate, we would have been limited to low speed. It would have wrecked our scheduling and dispatching. We never wanted the job. The money to us would have been okay, but it would probably have hurt us in the long run. The same thing would be true with them, wouldn't it? Even worse, the Shinkansen line's a high-speed passenger routing. They meet timetables like you wouldn't believe, and they wouldn't much like things that mess them up. He paused. Best guess? They use those cars to move the things from the factory to someplace else, and that's all. I'd bet a lot of money that they did everything at night, too. If I were you, I'd hunt around for these cars and expect to find them in a yard somewhere doing nothing. Then I'd start looking for trackage off the main line that doesn't go anywhere. Scott changed slides again. How well do you know their railroads? I've been over there often enough. That's why they let you draft me. Well, tell me what you think of this one. Scott pointed at the screen. At some bitchin' radar, a technician observed. The trailer had been flown up to Elmendorf to support the B-1 mission. The bomber crews were sleeping now, and radar experts, officer and enlisted rank, were going over the taped records of the snooper flight. Airborne phased array? A major asked. Sure looks that way. Sure as hell isn't the APY-1 we sold them 10 years back. We're talking over 2 million watts, and the way the signal strength jumps... Know what they've got here? It's a rotating dome, probably a single planar array, the master sergeant said. So it's rotating, okay, but they can steer it electronically, too. Track and scan? Why not? It's frequency agile. Damn, I wish we had one of these, sir. The sergeant picked up a photo of the aircraft. This thing's going to be a problem for us. All that power makes you wonder if they might get a hit. Makes me wonder if they were tracking the ones, sir. From that far out? The B-1B was not, strictly speaking, a stealthy aircraft. From nose on, it did have a reduced radar signature. From a beam, the radar cross-section was considerably larger, though still smaller than any conventional airplane of similar physical dimensions. Yes, sir. I need to play the tapes some more. What will you look for? The rotodome probably turns at about 6 RPM. The pulses we're recording ought to be at about that interval. Anything else, and they were steering the beam at us.
Good one, Sarge. Run it down.
Chapter 34 All Aboard Yamata was annoyed to be back in Tokyo. His pattern of operation in 30 years of business had been to provide command guidance, then let a team of subordinates work out the details while he moved on to other strategic issues, and he'd fully expected it to go easier in this case rather than harder. After all, the 20 most senior zaibatsu were his staff now, not that they thought of themselves that way. Yamata-san smiled to himself. It was a heady thought. Getting the government to dance to his tune had been child's play. Getting these men on board had taken years of cajolery. But they were dancing to his tune, and they just needed the bandmaster around from time to time. And so he'd flown back on a nearly empty airliner to steady down their nerves. "It's not possible," he told them. "But he said, Kozo, President Durling can say anything he wishes. I'm telling you that it is not possible for them to rebuild their records in anything less than several weeks. If they attempt to reopen their markets today, all that will result is chaos. And chaos, he reminded them, works in our favor. And the Europeans, Tanzan Itagaki asked. They will wake up at the end of next week and discover that we have bought their continent, Yamata told them all. In 5 years, America will be our grocer and Europe will be our boutique. By that time, the yen will be the world's most powerful currency. By that time, we will have a fully integrated national economy and a powerful continental ally. Both of us will be self-sufficient in all our resource needs.
We will no longer have a population that needs to abort its babies to keep from overpopulating our home islands. And, he added, we will have political leadership worthy of our national status. That is our next step, my friends. Indeed, Benichi Murakami thought behind an impassive face. He remembered that he'd signed on partly as a result of being accosted on the streets of Washington by a drunken beggar. How was it possible that someone as clever as himself could be influenced by petty anger? But it had happened, and now he was stuck with the rest. The industrialist sipped his sake and kept his peace, while Yamada-san waxed rhapsodic about their continent's future. He was really talking about his own future, of course, and Murakami wondered how many of the men around the table saw that. Fools. But that was hardly fair, was it? After all, he was one of them. Major Boris Shurenko had no less than 11 highly placed agents within the Japanese government, one of whom was the deputy head of the PSID, a man he'd compromised some years before while on a sex and gambling trip to Taiwan. He was the best possible person to have under control. It was likely that he would one day graduate to chief of the agency and enable the Tokyo Residentura both to monitor and influence counterintelligence activity throughout the country. What confused the Russian intelligence officer was that none of his agents had been of much help so far. Then there was the issue of working with the Americans. Given his professional training and experience, it was as if he were heading the welcoming committee for diplomats arriving from Mars. The dispatch from Moscow made it easier to accept, or somewhat easier. It appeared that the Japanese were planning to rob his country of her most precious potential asset in conjunction with China, and to use that power base to establish themselves as the world's most powerful nation. And the strangest thing of all was that Shurenko did not think the plan crazy on its face. Then came his tasking orders. 20 missiles, he thought. It was one area he'd never targeted for investigation. After all, Moscow had sold the things to them. They must have considered the possibility that the missiles could be used for... But no, of course, they hadn't. Shurenko promised himself that he'd sit down with this Clark fellow, an experienced man, and after breaking the ice with a few drinks, inquire delicately if the American's political direction was as obtuse as that which he received, regardless of the government in question. Perhaps the American would have something useful to say. After all, their governments changed every 4 or 8 years. Perhaps they were used to it. 20 missiles, he thought, 6 warheads each. Once it had been normal to think of missiles as things that flew in thousands, and both sides had actually been mad enough to accept it as a strategic fact of life. But now the possibility of a mere 10 or 20. At whom would they really be aimed? Would the Americans really stand up for their new, what, friends, allies, associates? Or were they merely former enemies whose new status had not yet been decided in Washington? Would they help his country against the new, old danger? What kept coming back to him was 20 missiles times 6 warheads. They would be evenly targeted, and surely enough to wreck his country. And if that were true, they would surely be enough to deter America from helping. Well, then, Moscow is right, Shurenko judged. Full cooperation now was the best way to avoid that situation. America wanted a location on the missiles, probably with the intention of destroying them. And if they don't, we will. The major personally handled 3 of the agents. His subordinates handled the others, and under his direction, messages were prepared for distribution to dead drops around the city. What do you know about? How many would answer his call for information? The danger was not so much that the people under his control would not have the information he needed, but that one or more of them would take this opportunity to report in to the government.
In asking for something of this magnitude, he ran the risk of giving one of his agents the chance to redeem himself by turning patriot, to reveal the new orders and absolve himself of any guilt. But some risks you had to run. After midnight, he took a walk, picking high traffic areas to place his drops and making the appropriate wake-up signals to alert his people. He hoped that the half of PSID he controlled was the one covering this area. He thought so, but you could never be sure, could you? Kimura knew he was running risks, but he'd gone beyond that kind of worry now. All he could really hope for was that he was acting as a patriot and that somehow people would understand and honor that fact after his execution for treason. The other consolation was that he would not die alone. "I can arrange a meeting with former Prime Minister Koga," he said simply. "Oh, shit," Clark thought at once. "I'm a goddamn spy," he wanted to reply. "I'm not with the goddamn State Department." The only good news at the moment was that Chavez didn't react at all. His heart had probably stopped, John told himself, like yours just did. "To what end?" he asked. "The situation is grave, is it not? Koga-san has no part in this. He is still a man of political influence. His views should be of interest to your government." "Yeah, you might say that." But Koga was also a politician on the outside, and perhaps willing to trade the lives of some foreigners for an open door back into the government, or just a man who placed country ahead of personal gain, which possibility might cut in just about any direction Clark could imagine. "Before I can commit to that, I need instructions from my government," John said. It was rarely that he temporized on anything, but this one was well beyond his experience. "Then I would suggest that you get it, and soon," Kimura added as he stood and left. "I always wondered if my master's in international relations would come in handy," Chavez observed, staring into his half-consumed drink. "Of course, I have to live long enough to get the parchment." "Might be nice to get married, settle down, have kids, maybe even have a real life someday," he didn't add. "Good to see you still have a sense of humor, Yevgeny Pavlovich." "They're going to tell us to do it, you know that." "Da," Clark nodded, keeping his cover, and now trying to think as a Russian would. Did the KGB manual have a chapter for this, he wondered. The CIA sure as hell didn't. As usual, the tapes were clearer than the instant analysis of the operators. There had been three, perhaps four, more likely four, given American operational patterns, the intelligence officers opined, aircraft probing Japanese air defenses. Definitely not EC-135s, however. Those aircraft were based on a design almost 50 years old and studded with enough antennas to watch every TV signal in the hemisphere and would have generated far larger radar returns. Besides, the Americans probably didn't have four such aircraft left. Therefore, something else. Probably their B-1B bomber, the intelligence people estimated. And the B-1B was a bomber whose purpose was far more sinister than the collection of electronic signals. So the Americans were thinking of Japan as an enemy whose defenses would have to be penetrated for the purpose of delivering death, an idea new to neither side in this war, if war it was, the cooler heads added. But what else could it be? The majority of the analysts asked, setting the tone of the night's missions. Three E-767s were again up and operating, again with two of them active and one waiting in the ambush role. This time the radars were turned up in power, and the parameters for the signal processing software were electronically altered to allow for easier tracking of stealthy targets at long range. It was physics they depended on. The size of the antenna combined with the power of the signal and the frequency of the electronic waves made it possible to get hits on almost anything. That was both the good news and the bad news, the operators thought, as they received all manner of signals now. There was one change, however. When they thought they had a weak return from a moving object at long range, they started directing their fighters in that direction. The Eagles never got within 100 miles. The return signals always seemed to fade out when the E-767 switched frequency from long-wave acquisition to short-wave tracking. And that didn't bode well for the Q-band needed for actual targeting. It did show them that the Americans were still probing, and that